Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, January 20th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and also available via podcast. More about that during the second half of the show. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to poets, authors, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with debut novelist Jen Began, author of Pretend I'm Dead, but first up, novelist Ryan Gaddis. Ryan is the author of the novels Rue Kick Kick and The Big Bad Blimp and Kung Fu High School, as well as the novellas The Big Drop Homecoming and The Big Drop Impermanence. He is a co-founder of the independent publisher Black Hill Press and a member of the urban art crew Uglar Works, certified wall artists for the city of Los Angeles. He earned a BFA in creative writing from Chapman University and an MA in creative writing from the University of East Anglia in Norwich, Connecticut, where he was supervised by the poet laureate. His new novel is All Involved, published by Echo, and it was released in paperback earlier this month. And I'm so pleased to welcome him to the show to talk about it. Hi there, Ryan.
Hi, Nicole.
Well, thanks for joining us. And let's go ahead and dive in. Could we have you introduce All Involved to us?
I can, but before we do, I actually went to school in Norwich, England, not Norwich, Connecticut.
Did I say Connecticut? I apologize.
Yes.
Norwich, England.
That's all right. That's not a problem. All Involved is really a novel about the 1992 LA riots. And I think being from Colorado, being an outsider to Los Angeles, my understanding of the riots was really what I saw on television. But being here in Los Angeles at a relatively turbulent time in my life, I met some incredibly fascinating people, from nurses to firefighters to perhaps most prominently former Latino gang members. And the more time I spent with them, the more I realized there really was a story to the LA riots that had never been covered, never been discussed. And that really had to do with the emergency services being somewhere else during that time of emergency, whether it was what happened in Florence and Normandy or the over 11,000 fires. How did that affect an incredibly gang-involved area in South Central, in this case, the city of Linwood. From what I could tell, it basically became the Wild West for 6 days. You know, no police, no fire, no emergency services, and a bunch of old scores were effectively settled during that time, and I just was really taken by that and decided to write about it.
And could you talk a bit more about the research that went into this book? I understand you spent a little more than 2 years.
Yeah, about 2.5, actually. A lot of that came from just being a part of Uglar. You know, I wasn't exactly sure. I'd hit a very severe bump in my writing career, if you could call it that, at that point. It was a trough to the effect of, you know, not having published anything for about 8 years at that point. And I thought I was done being a writer. I just so happened to meet some of the guys in Uglar. We just clicked immediately. And next thing I knew, I was effectively doing an internship on the streets of Los Angeles, going, you know, carrying paint for the guys, since I'm not a visual artist. It really, in some of the areas of Los Angeles that are classified as no-go areas for perhaps a lot of Angelenos, whether it was Linwood or City Terrace or Lincoln Heights or, you know, some of these traditionally gang-involved areas. And what I found when I was there was just, you know, really impressive breadth of humanity, and, you know, just what people were going through in those areas was very different, I think, to what most people think of in Los Angeles is like. And I just really just talk to people. You know, I think that was an incredibly large part of my process, was to listen.
And was there a point in hearing these stories and doing your research where you felt, okay, I'm done now, I can start? Or can you talk about beginning to work on the novel?
Sure. I don't know if there was ever quite that point. I think, if anything, it had to do with me having spent enough time with some former Latino gang members to have a sense of the argo, a sense of the culture, and really a very deep respect for, Chicano and Latino culture in general. And it eventually came to me that there was a female gang member I wanted to write, and this is the character Payasa. You know, there are 17 different narrators in the book. She's number two. She's really the main narrator of day one. And I actually went to three of these folks. They formed a council of sorts, you know, who they would help tell me, you know, yes, you can write this, you know, no, this might not be authentic. So it was incredibly helpful. And I went to them and I said, I really want to write a female gang member. And they all said no. Every single one of them said no. They said, you know, women weren't involved that way. That's not how it was. And, you know, I went home and I was just completely disconsolate. And because I think in a way she'd already been living in my head. And I think for two or three days, I was just a mess. But then I woke up and I felt, well, what if there's a scenario that gives her the opportunity to act with the freedom I need her to have in this given environment? And really that was when the riots came into play. You know, so it was this incredible sense of relief. Like, oh, wow, I get to write her, you know, thank goodness. But it was also this tremendous feeling of worry, just because I didn't know that anyone had written an in-depth novel on the LA riots yet, and that felt very heavy. It seemed to me there would be an awful lot of research involved, you know, in terms of nonfiction, newspapers, TV, everything, just to make sure I got the timing and the era as correct as I possibly could. And, you know, I went right back to those three folks after I'd written it, and I actually told them orally, okay, well, I wrote it. All of them were disappointed. But then I told them her story orally. You know, at first they were a bit reticent, and then near the end, you know, I noticed that they were just, that, like, their defenses were dropping a bit. And, you know, by the time I told them her story, you know, they all said, okay, you know, I like her. That sounds like that could work. And that was really the beginning of the novel.
Mm. And those people you were talking to, have they read the finished product?
Yes, absolutely.
And what was some of their feedback?
It's been phenomenal. You know, I've heard, you know, everything from that half the city of Linwood had read the book to I recently was up at San Quentin on a project for Amnesty International, and I was told by someone up there that nearly every death row inmate had read the book as well and loved it. And I think, you know, that kind of response, you know, from people who, you know, in that particular case, you know, have very much paid the cost for similar actions that I describe in the book was incredibly moving and humbling.
I'm talking to Ryan Gaddis. His new novel is All Involved. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Ryan, I really want to ask you about authenticity, because in this TEDx talk that is online and that we'll link to on the blog, you talk about the importance of it, but how do you achieve it?
Sure. You know, it's interesting. I think, A, that's a great question, and B, there are multiple answers. And the first one is that how do you achieve that in your daily life? And that's simply to find your truth and be willing to say it. You know, I think one of the things that I found very scary, but also liberating and incredibly important in terms of building my connections with people who really came from a very different background, you know, than the one I was raised in. You know, in particular, it was me telling the story of what happened to me when I was 17, my own experience with physical violence, how it completely changed my faith as well as my life. you know, and it's scary to tell that. But what I found was that really created a genuine connection, and it, I think it foregrounded humanity and empathy, and it backgrounded, you know, ethnicity and locality, which is, I think, is incredibly important and was really vital you know, in order to establish that connection and just help me prove to people, like, look, I'm in no way interested in being a tourist here. You know, I want to get to the heart of this. I want to get to the spirit of this era and really describe it in a way that's moving and engaging and hopefully answer some questions about the broader questions of why the riots happened in the first place, because I don't think, you know, the larger world actually understands that. So that was helpful. But then, you know, the second part of that is, how do you achieve authenticity in fiction, which, you know, would seem to be two diametrically opposed concepts? I would contend that they're not. You know, I think for me it was a matter of, you know, being as true as I possibly could be to what I thought the soul of the story was, and then, you know, really being willing and able to take that time and go sit down with the firefighters and say, look, you know, just check it, make sure it's right. You know, am I using the terminology correctly? You know, the scenario I've described, does it seem like it could happen? You know, that was huge. You know, it needs to, I think good fiction, or at least transcendent fiction, needs to pass that test. You know, and that's when it gets, when it can be dangerous, when it can be raw, when it can really push a reader to think. You know, because if we view it as complete artifice, you know, although that can have its uses in a way, I don't know that allows us to engage with a work in the way that, you know, a certain level of authenticity, or at least, you know, that can drop our barriers, and we can really just engage with the work as openly as possible.
Well, you completed a manuscript before this one, and can you talk about whatever, because that one, you have said it didn't find a home, right, in terms of a publishing?
I think the one you're talking about was the book I was working on for 8 years. Yeah.
Yes.
And it very definitely did not find a home.
Do you attribute that to a difference in authenticity? Or I struggle with this notion myself, and like how to get there, how to get at that place. And so, like, what growth happened for you, or what, you know, is, do you see that authenticity as being the flaw of that manuscript, or just?
Oh, wow. That's a phenomenal question. I've not actually thought of it in that way. I think, you know, that's probably valid. But I can tell you, for me, the issue was, I realized the type of writer I am not when I was writing that book. And that's, which is simply to say, I'm not a third person writer. I'm just not. I'm a voice writer. I need that first person, no remove from my characters. I need to be able to inhabit them in the best way I possibly can. And, you know, and I think that was the major issue with the other one. I completely over-researched it. Half of it was set very deeply in the past, in the 1700s, I believe, and the other half was set in the present day. You know, and as a result, I think I spent too much time kind of building, you know, the mind palace of that world, and perhaps not enough time engaging with the beat by beat emotional storytelling related to it. And as a result, it was incredibly long at one point. It was just way, way out of the realm of what makes, I think, a livable novel. But I think with All Involved, you know, where that paid off is I learned how not to write a long novel. And the way I wrote All Involved was for pace to be primary. But I will also say this, you know, in terms of the great Los Angeles writers, and we can, at least for me, it's, you know, it's Fonte, it's Chandler, it's Kane, as well as a few others, you know, Mosley, they write about Los Angeles in a very direct, very specific, very lived-in way. And Fonte in particular would really only write about places he'd been to, and he'd actually put his feet on the ground. And I find that, at least in my own process, that's incredibly helpful. I mean, when you're reading All Involved, and even the new book I'm working on, like, I've been there. I've walked around. I know what it's like. I've talked to people in that area. You can trust me. You can relax into that fiction and just let it go where the story is going to take you.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, it is so I mean, the first person really works. And like you said, there are 17 first person narratives. And you know what is really funny is I was ruminating about the structure about halfway through, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is in present tense, because normally I resist present tense for some reason,
sure.
But this is so natural for this, the momentum of this story and the immediacy of it.
Yeah, well, I'm right there with you. I resist present tense as well. I think all I try to do, however, is, you know, approach each project realizing it's going to have different goals. And in this case, you know, I tried to write Pyasa in past tense and it didn't work. It just didn't work. There's no danger in past tense. I think you know, you have a sense of, oh, okay, this character is going to survive. And I think it took away some of the velocity of this 6-day chaotic, incredibly historical event. So when I switched it to present tense, it felt electric. And I always wanted the reader to be on his or her toes and really worry and wonder, is this character going to make it out? Is this character going to be okay? You know, I think it's a tremendously different reading experience in that context.
Yeah, and plus there is the real possibility, as you prove a few times, you know, that they won't make it out. And that's, yeah.
Well, it's unfortunately true to the time.
Of course.
You know, there were over 3,000 murders in Los Angeles County in 92. It was very much an epidemic.
Yeah. And going back to your first-person narrators, I thought it was funny that at various times, I mean, you trust them, or the reader trusts them so much, because I'm reading along Little Creeper, and then he makes this golf reference, and I thought, oh, that's weird. And then right after that, he says, in essence, you know, what do you mean? Of course I watch golf on TV. And then he goes and addresses that, you know, directly to the reader. I thought that was funny.
Sure. No, I think that was definitely something I learned from the failures of the previous project, to have a sense of what a reader might be expecting and then either try to engage with that or knock it back. And I think in a case like this, especially with All Involved, it was easy for me because I was already an outsider to that world. So I figured if there were things that seemed a little bit different or strange to me, then if I addressed them, it would more than likely feel, you know, the same to most readers as well, without boxing out the folks who come from those areas and who've lived those lives and understand it anyway.
I'm talking to Ryan Gaddis. His new novel is All Involved. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Ryan, we don't have a ton of time, but I would love for you to read. Could you read maybe a couple paragraphs or a short section from the book?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I will read one paragraph.
Okay.
This is from Anthony's section, and he is an engineer with the LA Fire Department. This happens really in the absolute middle of the book. There's a helicopter overhead. Looks like Channel 7. Shining a light down on us like we're at the bottom of a deep, dark hole. The people who live around here, they know what that actually feels like. They know how ugly life can get. Everybody else, the people sitting at home watching this unfold on television, they have no idea. Those are the people shocked by the riots. They can't comprehend them because they don't understand the other side. They don't understand what happens to people with no money, who live in a neighborhood where crime is actually a viable career path when there are no other opportunities. And I'm not excusing it or condoning it or saying it can't be avoided, but I'm saying that's how it is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Ryan Gaddis reading from his new novel, All Involved. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Anthony brings to mind another question I had about structure, which is, so
sure.
When he's narrating, he revisits an episode we've already seen with a fire truck speeding down the road. And mm-hmm. So there's so many, you circle back so many times and it explains things in new light. And did you have butcher paper all over the place, or how did you organize this?
You know, it's funny. I think someone accused me of pulling a Homeland, you know, and having an entire wall of stuff everywhere. You know, it's and it wasn't quite to that extent, but I think it was something that also naturally occurred, you know, finding these opportunities for connections, opportunities to illuminate these new sides of our major plot threads that we're already going through it. I think it helps tremendously that, you know, my wife has perhaps the greatest plot brain of anyone I've ever met. You know, she grew up reading Dickens and Agatha Christie, and she also has a legal background. You know, she has prosecutorial experience in the LADA's office, so she's worked there. So, you know, her ability to kind of call me out on things and you know, see things coming a mile away. You know, I actually read her the book as it was being written. You know, that was how we avoided, you know, this book taking 8 years to write. You know, she said, "You will write, and then whatever you write, you will read to me whenever I come home from work," which was a wonderful impetus. But I can honestly say, you know, if the plot seems, you know, perfectly formed, it's mainly to do with the fact that it wasn't just a one-person job. You know, it was to speak very closely with my wife and, you know, the many people who were kind enough to lend their insight and experience to the research and background process.
Well, you mentioned Homeland, and the script, the book is very cinematic and visual, and I understand it has been optioned by HBO.
It has, yeah.
Can you tell us any more about that? Are there any plans for you to work on the script?
No plans to work on the script at this point. I think we're still kind of in the early stages. I have been brought on as an executive producer, so I'll certainly be part of, you know, the creative process. Mainly, though, I'm just working on the new book, and I'm just kind of keeping my fingers crossed because I've had my work option before and none of it has come to fruition. But I think HBO really gets it. You know, they really deeply understand the importance of, you know, these type of urban explication stories that I think can capture a city but can also capture an era. And I have very positive hopes for it. I think we're hopefully going to see something great.
Mm. And when you were speaking about your wife just now, you talked about some of her literary diet. How about you? Do you have any literary influences or books you'd like to recommend?
Oh my gosh. Absolutely recommend Ghetto Side, which was probably my book of the year, by Jill Leovi. It's a nonfiction book, and it's really about a fairly similar part of Los Angeles, but roughly, I think it's roughly 17, 18 years later from when I was writing. And in some cases, you can see the changes and the things that haven't changed since the riots. I think Atticus Lish's book, Preparation for the Next Life, is probably the best fiction book I read last year. Beyond that, of course, I recommend John Fonte, Raymond Chandler, James M. Cain, everything they've written.
Well, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I'd like to ask you a final question, which is, do you have any additional writing advice to share with our writer listeners?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. I'm on the spot. You know, honestly, I would say this. I had a fairly traditional writing education. You know, I did undergrad, I did master's. But what I found was, especially when I spent time speaking to people on the street, that didn't do service to the type of writer I am, which is an aural writer, A-U-R-A-L. You know, I need to listen. I need to hear voices in order to really trigger me. And before that, I'd always been told, oh, read tons of books and then go cloister yourself away. And I did that. And then it took me 8 years to write a terrible book. and I actually, you know, got quite unhealthy. You know, as a result of that, I honestly think, you know, it's important to go outside, you know, your boundaries, be willing to take risks, and, you know, always be willing to listen to people. You know, that I found to be the most valuable part of my writing life.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
That was Ryan Gaddis, author of the novel All Involved, published by Echo and now available in paperback. During the second part of the show, Jen Began, author of the book Pretend I'm Dead, will be here. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available on Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with novelist Ryan Gaddis. Up next, I'll be speaking with debut author Jen Biegun. Jen holds an MFA in creative writing from UC Irvine and has published stories in Juked and Faultline, among other journals and literary magazines. Her new novel is Pretend I'm Dead. It's published by Northwestern University Press. And I spoke with Jen a few days ago, and I first asked her to introduce her book.
Okay, Pretend I'm Dead is a novel, and it's divided into four sections. And each one is told from the point of view of Mona. Mona is lonely and depressed and in her early 20s. She cleans houses for a living. And when we first meet her, she's living in Lowell, Massachusetts, and volunteering at a needle exchange, handing out clean needles to addicts. And we learn that she's developed a crush on a junkie she calls Mr. Disgusting. Mr. Disgusting is 20 years older and toothless and basically penniless and also impotent. And he lives in a residential hotel. But she nevertheless falls for him and, perhaps needless to say, winds up with a broken heart, among other things. So that's the first section. Then Mona pulls a geographic to Taos, New Mexico, where she starts her own cleaning business. And the rest of the book centers around her relationship with her wacky neighbors and her new clients, onto which she projects a lot of her own baggage. And we witness her confronting her demons and just sort of growing up and becoming a whole person.
And the character of Mona feels really close. We're right there in her head, but it's in a close third, not first person. And so did you know from the outset that you would be telling the story in close third, or did you play around with first at all?
No, I never played around with first. I was, Mona's very much a mini-me, you know. She's, you know, based on my own life, but I didn't really want to narrate events from behind her eyes. I just preferred kind of being on her shoulder, you know? Mm. So I chose a close third. It was the only way I could really tell the story.
And so when you were developing Mona's character and the arc of the book, did you know at the beginning where you wanted Mona to be at the end of the novel, or did that work itself out?
That worked itself out in the writing, yeah. I don't know if it's super cool to admit, but my entry point was largely my own biography. So I was a self-employed cleaning lady for many years and a drifter type. I've pulled at least seven geographics similar to the one Mona pulls in the novel. And I also volunteered at a needle exchange in San Francisco for about 5 years. I wasn't writing fiction during any of that, but which is to say most of my life, but I've been a careful documenter of my own experience, mostly via photography and diaries and letters and so on. And so I had all this material, but that's all it was, material. It wasn't until I got into Irvine that I began to figure out how to use it and what form it should take.
You mentioned writing in a diary, and I read in another interview that you write your diary in close third, too. Is that?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? I thought that was fascinating. Have you always?
When I was a teenager, probably not, but yeah, it's just really natural for me to write in third person. I just feel really uncomfortable, like kind of icky writing in first person. I don't know what it is, but yeah, I've always gravitated toward the third person, you know?
And do you write in the diary every day? Is that something that now that you're writing fiction helps your process?
Well, it's not like a legit diary. You know what I use now is the Notes app on my iPhone. And I take like a daily sort of inventory. It's not like Dear Diary, she went to the blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it's like a daily inventory for sure.
I'm talking to Jen Biegun. Her debut novel is Pretend I'm Dead. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And another thing I wanted to ask you about that I learned about elsewhere was that you talked about working your way into a story through dialogue, and that you start your work with two people talking. Can you elaborate on that process?
So there's like scene and a summary, right? And I just feel most at ease writing scenes, like action and dialogue. I feel like I'm not very good at telling, which is to say narrating. So writing like long descriptive passages, unless they're part of scene, is actually like torture for me. So not to be dramatic, but I feel like I'm suffocating, or like I'm writing from inside a garbage bag. So writing dialogue is the opposite. It just comes really easily to me for some reason, and it's when I feel most alive as a writer. So the bag is gone, and I can breathe. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I write really crappy dialogue a lot of the time, but the point is I write a lot of it so I don't become overly attached. And I start most things with two people talking, and still it seems that not everyone likes reading a bunch of dialogue. I once gave a story to Andrew Sean Greer, who was a visiting professor at Irvine while I was there. And he was like, hey, great dialogue, but guess what? No one wants to read 20 pages. That's he said, she said, you know. And I was like, they don't? He said, it just makes it seem like you're not in control of the story. So that was hard to hear at first, because it made me realize how much I'd been relying on dialogue to get me through a draft. You know, it was kind of a crutch. But so he gave me some useful advice on how to break up these long sections of dialogue, like essentially what to show versus what to tell, or what to put in scene versus what to summarize. But I always write dialogue first.
That's interesting. I'm surprised he didn't spin it as more of a positive, because, I mean, dialogue as a crutch isn't a lousy crutch. I mean, it's hard for some people, I think, to show that way and to write those. They can write description, you know, all day long, but
oh god, I wish I was one of those people. I always, you know, I just have voices in my head, and it's kind of like transcribing those voices, you know. So I'll have like reams and reams of dialogue that I then have to like try and make a story out of.
And with this story, did you always know it would be a novel, or did it start as a short story?
It started as stories, yeah. It was written pretty much in the order it's in now. But I workshopped them as like long stories at Irvine. And then Ron Carlson told me that it was a novel, and I believed him. So, I tried to put some, like, you know, an overarching narrative through the whole thing, which I tried to do. I don't know if I really succeeded, but so Mr. Disgusting is kind of peppered throughout the whole novel. But originally it was like, you know, these discrete stories. Yeah.
And this
were very long.
Well, this is sort of a silly question, but so as you mentioned in the intro, so there are these four sections, and it starts off with Mona falling for Mr. Disgusting, and then subsequent three chapters are named after the characters that she encounters in those time periods. And so for the first section, which is not called Mr. Disgusting, it's called Whole. And so I wanted you to talk just a little bit about finding those chapter titles.
You know, I'm not super imaginative when it comes to titles. Whole was always Whole, and it's named after Lowell, which I called Whole in my head a lot. And then the other ones had, I think they had different titles at some point, and one of which was Pretend I'm Dead, which was the title for the Henry and Zoe chapter section. So the book had a different title, and we stole that from that section, and then I just named the sections after the characters.
I'm talking to Jen Began. Her debut novel is Pretend I'm Dead. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. And Jen, would you read to us from your book?
Oh, sure. Let's see. I'm going to read a bit of dialogue from the last section of the book. Mona is cleaning for a so-called psychic named Betty, who thinks her name is Maura, not Mona, and she lives in a trailer out in the middle of nowhere. And Betty is as lonely as Mona is, and she likes to follow her around while she's cleaning. So in the scene, Mona's just finished cleaning, and Betty wants to do a little psychic experiment with her in the living room. Okay, Betty said, I want to do a little experiment with you. I'm going to think of a number between 1 and 20. You're going to first re-see it, then read it to me. You're going to have to look me right in the eye and really concentrate. Oh, God, Mona said. Just try it, Betty said. It won't kill you. Mona would rather have a rock thrown at her head. I'm thinking of a number, Betty said. I'm projecting it nice and large. Mona stared at Betty's perfectly shaped left eyebrow, but could only concentrate on the strange guttural noise one of her cats was making outside. The cat sounded as if it were repeating the word ouch. Ouch, it kept saying over and over. Betty, Mona said, is that your cat? It sounds like it's in pain. I feel really bad if it got eaten by a coyote while I was reading your mind. She's fine, Betty said. She's just in heat. Now stop fouling and look at me. She pointed to her eyes. Here. Mona locked eyes with Betty. A whole minute seemed to go by. This was by far the most eye contact she maintained in months, perhaps ever. Betty's blue eyes, she noticed now, were flecked with some other color. Gold? No, copper. Jesus, they were stunning. No wonder she covered them with contacts. They were too beautiful to be seen naked. She realized it was probably time to say a number. 11, she said. Betty shook her head. You have to really concentrate. She counted to 12 and wondered if blue-eyed psychics were more successful than brown-eyed ones. Probably. 18, she said. You're guessing, Betty said. Don't guess. Just wait until you see it. 14. Very good, Betty said, clapping her hands. Now it's my turn. Think of a number and project it nice and big so I can see it. Project it where? On my forehead, Mona said. Just hold it in your mind. Maybe we should be wearing aluminum feelers on our heads, Mona said. It might make things easier. Do you have a number? Betty asked impatiently. Yes. 20, 20, 20, she repeated to herself, visualizing a number. 20, Betty said after 5 seconds. Good guess, Mona said. I must be inadvertently cueing you somehow. Oh, please, Betty said. I'm psychic, silly. When are you going to stop mocking me? Probably never, Mona thought. Okay, Maura, Betty said. You're up. Mona stared hard into Betty's eyes again, waiting for a number to come into her head. She was about to say 9 before Betty stopped her and said, try again. 5, Mona said. Yes, Betty said. I knew you'd be good at this. Okay, my turn. Mona thought of the number 3. She repeated it to herself, but was careful not to move her lips or blink. She projected it onto a drive-in movie screen in her mind. Very good, Maura. I can see your number more clearly now, Betty paused. The number 3, that is. Whoa, Mona said. You're freaking me out. They went back and forth several times. It didn't get any easier for Mona, but after staring into Betty's eyes for a minute or two, she could suddenly see the numbers, large silver numbers on a blue background. When she read the number out loud, a kind of euphoria washed over her. She felt drunk and in love. As she was leaving, she asked, why do you think I can see the numbers? I'm not psychic. Oh, everyone has some psychic ability, Betty said. It's just a matter of being open. You have to learn how to see first, and then you simply read what you see. Sometimes it's very clear-cut. Other times it takes some interpretation on your part. Then there are certain other kinds of knowledge that are already there inside you. And the process of seeing and reading is a process of recovery, of recovering knowledge you already know. Mona tilted her head as if she were hanging on Betty's every word, but she was actually in screensaver mode. Physically present, yes, but the rest of her was miles away in her apartment, disrobing and climbing into bed. When she did finally go to bed that night, she slept a miraculous 12 hours straight without once getting up to do the usual things, guzzle water, despond, pee, eat peanut butter from the jar with her fingers, despond again.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
That was Jen Began reading from her debut novel, Pretend I'm Dead. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. And I found this character of Betty so intriguing. So she calls herself a psychic. And in that scene, there are lots of coincidences that lead the reader to believe there's a good chance she's for real. And it's it was a bold move, I thought, because it's kind of a fine line. It can be overplayed. But you know, how hard was it to find that line? Because you play it for intrigue and humor, like with her name, you know, Maura and Mona, and some creeps too, but it's never too much. And so did you, how did you Was that a tough line, or did it come naturally?
Well, you know, she's based on an actual person I cleaned house for. I cleaned house for a psychic like a million years ago, and she lived in a trailer and drove a fancy car, and she called me Jan instead of Jen. And I waited probably a year to tell her that my name was Jen. I also took pictures of her ex-husband, which was fun, but I never actually met the guy or befriended his nephew or any of that. Wait, what was your question again?
Oh, just about painting Betty as a psychic and not overplaying it, but...
Right. Well, you know, I mean, so I had, like, this actual person, you know, and I feel, you know, I like, much of this is about, for me, this novel is, like, turning my life into fiction, you know, and for that I needed, like, a certain amount of detachment, so I needed to be willing to let go of the facts, and the fact was that she was probably not a real psychic, you know, but, yeah, I needed to let go of that because it wasn't, I don't know, it just wasn't doing anything for the story. So, yeah, I mean, I told that story to my friends orally, you know, while we were getting drunk or whatever, without embellishing or changing the facts of it.
Do you mean regarding the numbers or?
Oh, just, yeah, everything.
Okay.
Well, the numbers part was pure fiction, okay. You know. But, you know, I mean, I was writing about an actual person, and she did, like, you know, we channeled photographs together, and, you know, a lot of what happens in the novel, like, happened a little bit in life, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, I was telling that story to my friends a lot, and I could kind of see where I would lose them, and so I just, I make stuff up, you know? So, yeah, I embellished. I just made her a little more psychic than she actually was.
And regarding revising generally, how does that work for you? Do you go from start to finish, or do you kind of revise as you go along, or what does that look like?
Let's see. Well, I write early in the mornings, and then I tend to revise, like, in the afternoons, I guess.
Do you revise what you just wrote that morning, or do you take something older?
Yeah, I just kind of, like, rework the sentences that I came up with in the morning. Yeah. As far as, like, huge overall revisions, most of it for me is about deleting stuff. It's like kind of just paring everything down. I write a lot, and then I just pretty much delete a lot of it. You know, that's what revision is for me, mostly.
And do you have a critique partner or a critique group?
God, no, I wish I did. No, nothing. I don't have it. Well, I have a couple of friends from the program that I send stuff to. Yeah, I kind of write in isolation, you know. And then when I have something to show, I send it to, like, maybe two people.
I like to ask debut novelists about their paths to publication. So did you work with an agent, or did you courier directly to the presses?
You know, I tried to get an agent, like, way back when, maybe in 2012 or something. And I sent it to maybe five agents. And two of them got back to me with some notes, but they both ultimately passed. And I just gave up. I was like, oh, forget it, you know. This isn't going to happen. And so, I just kind of stuck it in a drawer and forgot about it, you know, and started working on something else. And, then a friend of mine who had published with Tri-Quarterly, Northwestern, gave his editor my name, and his editor contacted me, and then he read the first, I don't know, 100 pages, and he's like, I want this. And I said, you might want to read the second 100 pages, you know? But, he wanted it, and, yeah, that's how it came to be. So I'm still agentless. But I have a really good editor at Northwestern, and I feel really lucky.
That's an incredible story. But you got, after five query letters, you got discouraged? Oh, my goodness.
I did, yeah. I guess, you know, I just got discouraged, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, I just figured it wasn't that good, you know, or something. And yeah, I just kind of gave up. Yeah. So.
Well, I'd like to talk about the end of your novel and tying up that portion of Mona's experience and her search. Can you talk about finding your ending? Did you have to write around it or write past it, or was it, how did it appear?
Well, you know, I always wanted it to end where it does, you know. But it's kind of an abrupt ending. Still, that's the ending I always wanted. And then I was, you know, I don't know who I was pandering to, but I was like, oh no, we need another chapter where we need a happier ending, basically. So I wrote this absurd chapter. I don't know if this is absurd, but where she gets a dog. She's cleaning another house and she gets a dog. Except I don't tell the reader it's a dog. I let them think it's like a man. And she like falls in love with this thing, you know, you don't know if it's a man or a dog, which is just completely ridiculous and something I would have like, you know, severely chastised my students for doing, you know, like, so at the end it's like, surprise, it's a dog, you know? So, it just wasn't working, but I had that ending when I gave it to, my editor at Northwestern, and he was like, you know, you can get rid of that chapter. And I was like, thanks, you know, thank you. And so, yeah, it went back to where I wanted it to end.
Well, I'm talking to Jen Began. Her debut novel is Pretend I'm Dead. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Jen, we're running out of time, but before I let you go, I'd like to ask if you have any writing advice for the writers listening.
Well, I can only tell you what works for me, and that's writing in bed in longhand when I'm half asleep. So that's when all the good stuff comes out for me. It took me a long time to figure out why that is, and I think it's because my inner critic doesn't seem to wake up until about 9:07 a.m. So ideally, I should write from 4 a.m. to 8:45 or so, but instead I write from about 6 a.m. to 10:30, and so I have to endure my inner critic telling me I'm a hack for about an hour and a half. At any rate, I think it's important to know like when you're and a critic is asleep or snoozing, you know, and to build your writing practice around those hours. Another thing that worked for me in writing this book is that I got Mona's name tattooed on my stomach. This was at a point when my personal life was getting away in the way of my writing, and I feared that I was going to abandon Mona and not finish the book. And a tattoo helped. It's like a symbol. It's simple and unadorned, you know, nothing fancy. It's just her name and typewriter script. But I would stare at it for a minute or two when I had some drama going on, and it helped me snap out of it and kind of refocus. So, I mean, this probably only works if you're not already covered in ink, in which case I recommend getting the tattoo on your face or something. Anyway, I remember telling Ron Carlson about the Mona tattoo, and I said something like, now I have to finish the book or else how embarrassing would that be, you know? And he said, no, no, you don't have to finish it. You just change it from Mona to Monastery, which I thought was hilarious. And the last thing is, I think taking walks and taking naps is really good for writing. I think any problem you're having in your writing will work itself out when you're either walking or sleeping.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was author Jen Began. Her new novel, Pretend I'm Dead, is out and published by Northwestern University Press. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for Filling the Voids with Natalia, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.